Levine, and this is the Burrow Report.
On March 26th, the U.S. Supreme Court will begin hearing oral arguments on the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, the Obama administration's landmark health care reform law passed in 2010. The court will consider several constitutional challenges to the law and could let it stand, strike down all or part of it, or simply put off taking action. We spoke to Tevi Troy, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and former Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in the Bush administration, about the case, what the issues are before the court, and why any ruling from the Supreme Court won't end the fight over health care reform. Tevi, thanks for joining us.
Danny, thanks for having me.
So the U.S. Supreme Court will be hearing oral arguments in a case that challenges the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, the landmark health care reform from the Obama administration. I think it might be useful to begin with the actual questions the justices will be considering. Can you walk us through this, maybe starting with the biggest question facing the legislation, the individual mandate? What is the individual mandate, and what's the constitutional question?
Sure, happy to discuss it. And I'd heard a little something about the Supreme Court might be doing something on health next week, so I'm glad you're raising the issue. The individual mandate is really at the heart of the Obama health legislation. It says that individuals must purchase health insurance. Now, this provision is important because it basically enabled the insurance companies to come on board with some of the additional requirements that the Obama health care law imposed on them, such as covering people from age 19 to 26 on their parents' insurance, things like guaranteed issue and community rating, things that make it harder for insurance companies to make distinctions between possible participants in their plans. The idea is if they have to take all comers, then at least everybody will be participating in the system, even the healthier, wealthier, younger people who have tended to stay out of the system. So it's sort of an economic trade-off. Force people to participate in the system, but have more restrictions on the insurance companies in terms of their sifting ability.
So from a constitutional point of view, what's the issue?
Right. And that is an excellent question, because from a legislative standpoint, I guess the legislators can do what they want, and health economists have talked about provisions along the lines of this for many years. From a constitutional standpoint, it's an interesting question, because for the last few decades, the assumption has been that under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, the Congress can pretty much do what it wants if it links it to interstate commerce. Any activity can be governed or regulated according to interstate commerce. The reason that this is different, or may be different, according to what the justices say, is that right now we're looking at something called economic inactivity. You have to purchase health insurance, or would have to purchase health insurance, by virtue of being alive. It doesn't regulate your activity, meaning your purchasing of a car necessitates you getting auto insurance. If you exist, you must have health insurance. And so there's a question of whether the individual mandate can apply to economic inactivity. And that is something that I don't think the court has done before, but that doesn't mean that the court won't accept it in this case.
Another question the justices are going to consider is severability, the question of whether the individual mandate can be removed from the law without having the legislation collapse in on itself. Is it unusual to see a legislation like this passed without having a severability clause to begin with?
Well, yes, absolutely it's unusual. And that was part of the reason in the way in which the bill was passed. If you remember, Scott Brown won that Senate seat to replace Ted Kennedy, which took away a 60-vote filibuster-proof majority from the Democrats. At that point, the only option for the Democrats for passing the bill was something called reconciliation. Under the rules of reconciliation, the House and Senate had to pass the exact same legislation, and it couldn't be amended or changed in any way. The severability clause and its absence from the legislation was an oversight. Some say intentional oversight, but it's unclear of the provenance of the oversight. But regardless, it was unable to be fixed because you didn't have a budget, a legislative conference after the passage of the law in both houses to reconcile differences between them. You had to go with the exact same language in both houses, and that's what led to the absence of the severability clause. Now, from a constitutional perspective and from a legislative perspective, the The legislative mandate, or the individual mandate, is really at the economic heart of the bill, as I explained earlier. But there's a question of, if the mandate goes away, is it so necessary to the legislation that most of the rest of the legislation must go too? There was one judge in Florida, Judge Vinson, who said that the whole thing would have to be overturned. Thus far, he's the only judge who, in a majority opinion, has said the whole thing would have to be overturned, but that's something the justices are going to look at.
So there's another issue that you seem downright disappointed the justices will consider, just based on the sheer boredom factor. That's the issue of the Anti-Injunction Act. Is that a little arcane?
It is very arcane. But as with this whole case, I mean, if you're a health nerd as I am and as you are, nothing about this case is really boring. The Anti-Injunction Act is a relatively obscure provision that says that you cannot challenge the constitutionality of a tax unless and until that tax applies. And the argument that is made is that the tax, or the individual mandate, it's a question of whether it's a tax or not, but the individual mandate does not apply until after 2014, meaning when you do your tax returns in April of 2015. So, you know, 4 years right now, people would be dealing with the individual mandate tax. Now, the Obama administration has interestingly argued, for political reasons, that the mandate is not a tax, and the OMB director has made that argument, and they made that argument in Congress. For legal reasons, because they want the Anti-Injunction Act to apply here, they've argued that it is a tax. So it puts the legal and sort of political policy teams at odds with each other. But nevertheless, that's one of the questions the justices are going to look at.
And the last issue has to do with the burden the legislation creates for states. Can you explain what health care reform means to states over time and what the issue the justices will consider in that regard?
Yeah, the Affordable Care Act covers 32 million Americans. 32 million additional Americans. So if you remember, President Obama used to talk about 47 million people uninsured. According to CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, we are slated to have 54 million uninsured by 2019. With the Affordable Care Act in effect, that number would decrease by 32 million. So only 22 million would be uninsured. I say only, but it's still a huge and terrible number. Of those 32 million additional covered people, 16 million of them would be covered by Medicaid, which, as you know, is a federally financed, for the most part, but largely state-run program. By putting 16 million people, more people on Medicaid, and by increasing the poverty rate at which people, or the rate at which people would be included on poverty, up to 138% of poverty, by doing those things, you place additional burdens on states in terms of Medicaid payments. Now, at the same time, the federal government said, we're going to pay 100% of these costs for the first few years. And states say, great. But some of the states, including Governor Mitch Daniels of Indiana, say, well, you're going to cover the first 2 years, but in subsequent years, I think I'm likely to be left holding the bag. And given our budgetary situation in Washington, that is indeed a likely occurrence. At the same time, the states have their own budgetary issues. So the states are saying, this is a huge economic imposition on us, and we are very concerned about this imposition and some of the additional mandate insurance requirements that would be included as well. So that's the question at heart here.
So let's talk about possible outcomes. This is not merely a thumbs up, thumbs down from the court. What are the different ways this can play out?
I see four possible outcomes, and I'm going to say them in terms of likelihood, although anybody who tells you that they know with certainty what's going to happen is not telling you the truth.
Okay.
So the first two are the most likely. Number one and number two, I rate them sort of co-equal. One is that the court overturns the individual mandate but keeps the rest of the law in place. That would be problematic from multiple perspectives, but from the economic viability of the law, it would be a real problem, and there would have to be some kind of legislative fix to make the law viable in the future, because otherwise premiums are going to go way up if there's no individual mandate and there are just additional requirements on the insurance companies. The second most likely scenario, which again I rated around the same as the first, is that the justices say, okay, the whole law is fine, no problems, no changes, no issues, and we will keep it as is. Right now there are at least four votes on the court that are willing to vote that way, so they only need one more vote to get there. And Justice Kennedy has been cited as the most likely justice to go along with the four liberal justices, but other people have speculated that perhaps Chief Justice Roberts or maybe even Justice Scalia might go along, because there's a sense that they are rule of law types who may not like the legislation, but they may not see a constitutional difficulty with it. The third most likely, I think, is under the obscure Anti-Injunction Act that we discussed a few moments ago, and that is the punt, push this off for 2 or 3 years until the mandate actually applies to people, and so I rate that as the third most likely. And the least likely of the four, I think, is that they vote to overturn the entire legislation as Judge Vinson did.
All right, well, let's assume the court upholds the Affordable Care Act. What's the likelihood that the Republicans say, okay, well, you know, we don't like it, but everything's hunky-dory now?
I think that would be a 0% likelihood, and I think you knew that when you asked the question.
So
the Republicans, obviously all four Republican presidential candidates, have said that they would repeal this. You know, it's an interesting question. 2 years ago, this week, the law passed, and usually the history of these kind of things is that the American people, even if a bill is contentious, say, okay, it's now the law of the land, we're going to move on. In this case, that has not happened for a variety of reasons. Some blame the partisanship in Washington. Others say that the bill is done in a unipartisan way. Others say the intrusiveness of the mandate and the cost of the bill. But whatever the reason, the bill is still contentious 2 years later.
So do we see a situation where the Republicans try to overturn it outright, or do they try to dismantle it piece by piece?
If the Republicans win the White House and both houses of Congress in the fall, they will definitely pursue an overall repeal of the entire bill. I don't think there's any doubt on that front. However, the odds are that the election won't be that clean a victory for either side, and you'll continue to have the muddle we have now in Washington. So let's say Republicans win the House again and gain control of the Senate, but President Obama wins the White House, retains the veto pen. He would not be signing a bill that overturned his or that overruled his favorite provision of law. So that's one scenario. Or the Republicans can gain the White House, but the Senate is likely to be very close. So I think there's going to be continued political struggle on this, and whatever levers of power the Republicans have after the November election, they will use to pursue dismantling of the law in whatever capacity they can. So whether it's dismantling outright repeal, defunding certain aspects, holding up the regulations, I could see all of those happening. At the same time, Democrats will use every tactic that they have to try and hold on to the law and make sure that it is implemented on time.
Well, it's been said that this isn't health care reform, but rather insurance reform. You've criticized the laws driving costs, discouraging innovation, increasing dependency on government, and adding to the burden of entitlements. But assuming the law stands, is additional health care reform needed?
Oh, absolutely. As I said earlier, there's still going to be 22 million uninsured, even with this law in place. The costs are going to be going up, and I think sometime around 2016, there's going to be a holy cow moment. I could say a saltier word for it, but a holy cow moment in which the budget experts, the budget wonks at CBO and OMB and all those places say, this is just not affordable. There are more people who are joining the exchanges than we anticipated. There are more employers who are dumping coverage than we anticipated. The medical costs have not gone down, and we're not going to be able to afford this, and it's going to send us to bankruptcy sooner than anticipated. I hope that we don't have to wait until it's an actual crisis, a la Greece, before we act on it, but I would like to see some kind of bipartisan fixes to this before we get to that ugly state.
Okay, so now that was the easy stuff. So here's the tough one. How do you fix healthcare?
I think what we've learned from President Obama's approach, which was an overarching, let's fix everything at once approach, that is neither easy to do, probably not workable, and not necessarily to the liking of the American people. So I would like to see smaller, more incremental steps to try and improve what we have. I'd like to see medical malpractice reform, which President Obama has even spoken favorably of to some degree, although he didn't do much on it. I would like to see the allowance of people to purchase insurance across state lines to get more competition in the insurance company, among the insurance companies. I'd like to see association health plans let people band together under their church or their union or some kind of civic organization to give them another way of purchasing health care rather than just through their employer or the expensive way as individuals that's not tax-favored. I'd also like to see some kind of tax credit that goes to individuals for the purchase of health insurance. And it doesn't have to be a tax credit per se. It could be a tax exclusion. There are different ways, but some kind of tax advantage to individuals for purchasing health insurance to encourage the purchase of health insurance without necessarily making it a mandate.
Teddy Troy, senior fellow at Hudson Institute and former deputy secretary for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services under the Bush administration. Teddy, thanks so much for your time again.
Always happy to be on the Burrell Report.
Thanks for listening. For information on Burrell & Company conferences and publications, go to burrellandco.com. That's burrillandco.com. And be sure to join us at burrellreport.com for daily coverage of the life sciences industry. And sign up for our free e-newsletter, the Burrell Weekly Brief, by hitting the sign-in link at the top of our website.